Thank you very much. It's a relief to know that my title is as long as Thomas's. I want to thank Father Dominic Legg also for the invitation, for all of you for being here. It's a real pleasure and an honor for me. Anyone who doubts whether much is at stake in the question that has brought us together need only consider an interview recently broadcast on BBC Radio. An Italian neurosurgeon, Sergio Canavero, claims that the medical technology now exists to transplant human heads, which he seeks to demonstrate within the next 2 years. The procedure would involve severing someone's head entirely from his or her body and reattaching it from the spinal cord out to a donor body that represents, according to Canavero, simply an extension of the harvesting of donor organs. He will propose at a June meeting in Annapolis that this first be done in the United States, but that if Americans or other Westerners prove squeamish or otherwise unreceptive, he will move forward with the Chinese, whom he reports, quote, are big on it and are already working on it. Asked whether the notion strikes many people as problematic, akin perhaps to something conjured out of Dr. Frankenstein, Canavero refers to a psychological reaction against the prospect of seeing for a few seconds a detached human head prior to the beginning of its surgical reattachment to an entirely new, that is, someone else's, human body. He seems to imply that unsettled spectators would get over it once the reattachment was completed. The BBC interviewer seemed unhesitatingly to accept the benefit of such a procedure for a paraplegic or quadriplegic, worrying only about the potential for abuse in the instance of elderly patients wanting a second young person's body for purposes of prolonging or reinvigorating their lives, quote, or even people just swapping for cosmetic reasons. Canavero calls this possibility for abuse the key point and explains, with no sense of discernible irony or sarcasm, that this is why he prefers the procedure be carried out, quote, in a Western country where every legal and ethical procedure is being respected. I'm not making this up. Asked whether he will go elsewhere if no Western country supports his proposal, Canavero replies, absolutely, and explains that the 2-year time frame is mentioned simply as a realistic one to assemble the team of approximately 150 medical and technical personnel to carry out the procedure. Quite apart from whether such unprecedentedly ambitious neurosurgery is actually doable, as Canavero claims, his proposal raises numerous disturbing questions. I would like to make just 2 points by way of introduction to my talk. First, here is someone whose anthropological assumptions are such that human bodies below the base of the brain are so secondary to what it means to be human as to be literally interchangeable appendages to personhood. If such a surgery was successful, and at age 50-something, for example, I got the donor body of a 20-something brain-dead accident victim, my head attached to his body would ostensibly still be me. We see, then, that claims about human personhood are embedded throughout society and far from merely theoretical. My second point is that the harrowing distance between the anthropological assumptions of someone such as Dr. Canavero and Catholic views about the human person should impress upon Catholic intellectuals the importance of being able to engage with and to criticize them in ways that have a chance to be persuasive. So it occurred to me that I might perhaps be most useful at this conference by offering some reflections not on fundamental philosophical or theological anthropology per se, which can be and is being done by my colleagues much better than I could do it, but rather on the importance of being able to address different audiences as Catholic intellectuals. My own experience of this and related matters is now that of a historian and Catholic academic who teaches at Notre Dame, but who taught for 7 years at Stanford University, and whose principal intended scholarly audience is non-Catholic and decidedly secular. So the secular audience of the Academy is more or less the main focus of my talk today. The basic point I'm going to be developing is that if we want to be persuasive communicators of and witnesses to the truth of the Catholic view of a human person, it behooves us to know who our audience is and what their assumptions are. This awareness suggests, or should suggest, how we ought most fruitfully to approach the matter of what to say about human beings and how to say it, if we want to have some chance of being persuasive. I think all of us are aware that the dominant views of the wider society, and even more explicitly of the Academy, do not align with Catholic anthropological views. Indeed, it is difficult not to be constantly reminded of this fact, even if it doesn't always appear in a form as dramatic as my opening anecdote. There is some commonality here, I hope, not only with fellow Catholic academics, but also a parallel with the new evangelization for Dominicans, other religious, clergy, and lay people, insofar as our charge and challenge includes the attempt to reach those who are non-Catholic, non-Christian, and non-religious. The matter isn't simple, of course, because contemporary American audiences are rarely homogeneous in their basic beliefs and values. Moreover, the instantaneous character of communication now means that even largely homogeneous audiences are often quickly mixed in fact, at least for ideas and texts, in both senses of the word, that are posted and forwarded online. In addition, a one-on-one conversation lends itself to a pastoral intimacy very different in kind from an article or book or blog post, the extent of whose readership we don't know in advance. Successful argument, like successful evangelization, is hard work that requires multidimensional prudence and sensitivity contingent on many particulars. Those specifics are beyond the scope of my remarks today, but I wanted at least to signal my awareness of their importance. That said, it seems worth distinguishing between largely Catholic audiences, such as this one, and predominantly secular audiences, because they hold importantly different assumptions about human beings. One size does not fit all. What might be persuasive, incisive, and edifying to the former is likely to be unconvincing, mystifying, and perhaps even outrageous to the latter. If, taking our inspiration from St. Paul, and it seems to me also from St. Dominic, we seek to become all things to all people, that we might by all means save some, that is, might lead them as human persons willingly to consider, or deepen as the case may be, the shared life in Christ that we know from experience is true and life-giving and thus something we want to share, we should be strategic in how we go about it. How we proceed will be different with those who share our assumptions than it is with those who don't. Now, I'm going to spend most of my time in my lecture this morning talking about the latter case, but partly in order to draw out the difference, I'll say something first about addressing fellow Catholics who share our assumptions on the subject of human persons. As we've already seen in abundance at our gathering these 2 days, there is no shortage of engaging subject matter for discussion about the human person in a Catholic context. Yet the basic parameters for our discussion, indeed the conditions that allow it to be a conversation of a certain kind, derived from the shared assumptions about the human person within a Catholic worldview. These are not in dispute in contexts like this. Rather, they permit us to explore and explicate, to ask questions about the mystery and density and destiny of personhood, for example, that makes sense within the boundaries established by the commitments that circumscribe the discourse. By these commitments, I mean basic claims that have structured discussions at least implicitly yesterday and today, the biblically based views interpreted by the tradition and given relatively recent magisterial expression in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, for example, that human beings are part of reality understood as God's creation, are created male and female in the image of God, and possess an inherent dignity in having been called to share in God's life by the ways in which they live out their own, a sharing that will reach its culmination only after death, and indeed, eschatologically. As the Catechism puts it, here echoing a phrase associated with Robert Spemann, also referred to by Professor Pfau, being in the image of God, the human individual possesses the dignity of a person who is not just something, but someone. He is capable of self-knowledge, of self-possession, and of freely giving himself and entering into communion with other persons, that relationality. And he is called by grace to a covenant with his Creator to offer him a response of faith and love that no other creature can give in his stead. So too, with respect to the character of the human person, our basic assumptions include the belief that persons are beings at once corporeal and spiritual. And while there is much room for reflection on the ways in which human body and soul are related, their integral unity is fundamental. Here again from the Catechism, the unity of soul and body is so profound that one has to consider the soul to be the form of the body. That is, it is because of its spiritual soul that the body made of matter becomes a living human body. Spirit and matter in man are not two natures united, but rather their union forms a single nature. This way of putting it, drawn from the Council of Vienne in 1312, is Aristotelian in a manner that I'm wildly guessing is more or less congenial to the present audience. Other passages in the Catechism arguably lend themselves more readily to a Platonic interpretation of the relationship between body and soul. In addition, references to the human spirit and heart are biblical appellations that also find their place in the tradition and the Catechism, but their relationship to body and soul is not worked out in either in any definitive, systematic manner. There are also rich possibilities for more overtly phenomenological explications of these basic claims about human beings as created in God's image, possessing an inherent dignity, and comprising a psychosomatic unity, as, for example, Father Sokolovsky has shown. So there is no shortage of prospects for important discussion on these and related issues about human vocation, flourishing, morality, and destiny, related to and derived from fundamental anthropological considerations within a Catholic context and on the basis of Catholic commitments. This is one sort of discourse that seeks insight and offers answer to the question, what is a human person? It makes sense, and our discussion can be fruitful because of our shared assumptions. With secular audiences, including most academic contexts, the matter is quite otherwise. Prevailing assumptions about human beings and very often also about the nature of reality itself differ in important ways, sometimes dramatically so, in a manner that affects the character of discourse about the human person. Our challenge is accordingly much greater, I would argue, than that which John Henry Newman faced in England in the late 1840s, when shortly after his conversion, he offered his discourses addressed to mixed congregations, to audiences comprised of both Anglicans and Catholics. A wild range of diversity there. Those religiously divided Victorian audiences shared much more in common than Catholics share with contemporary secular audiences. If people do not believe a loving creator God is real, then correlatively they do not believe that the universe is God's creation, or that human beings are created in God's image, or have a supernatural vocation or postmortem destiny. And very likely they also do not believe that human beings have a soul, at least not in the sense affirmed in the Catholic tradition. Hence, they might think that human heads can be severed from bodies and reattached to new bodies without grave implications for personhood or morality. These countervailing assumptions about the nature of reality and human beings present challenges to those of us who, convinced of the truth and life-giving importance of the Catholic view of human persons, want ultimately to persuade others to embrace it for themselves. This is consistent with Christ's imperative to share the gospel, and the extension of this imperative in the papal exhortations of the new evangelization, initiated by John Paul II, continued by Benedict XVI, and by Pope Francis. How might we realistically try to do this? How might we hope that our arguments about human persons are at least persuasive enough to be, as the phrase goes, taken seriously by an audience initially inclined to reject them? Let's start with the negative. What we should not do, it seems to me, is use categories and argue on the basis of assumptions not shared with our target audience. Here, and I hope I don't step on any toes at least too strongly, well-intentioned Catholics, I think, are sometimes naive in thinking that natural law arguments are likely to be effective. In his 2009 address on education and the challenge of contemporary culture, Father Michael Sweeney, from your own institution, commented on the inability of liberal democracies to sustain themselves without the moral foundation provided by Christianity. He said, quote, "The popes and bishops have not been silent on these questions, but they have been dismissed because they are not understood. When they speak of the natural law, or of the common good, or of solidarity, or of subsidiarity, they are using terms that are inaccessible and therefore largely meaningless to the majority of Catholics, let alone of other citizens." I think this observation correctly diagnoses a basic problem, one to which Cardinal Ratzinger also referred shortly before he became pope in his exchange with Jürgen Habermas, when he said of natural law that, quote, "this instrument has become blunt. Accordingly, I do not intend to appeal to it for support in this conversation," right? The "in this conversation" is the crucial qualifier. And as the Orthodox theologian David Bentley Hart, too, put it in an essay that stirred some controversy 2 years ago, quote, If we all lived in a Platonic or Aristotelian or Christian intellectual world in which everyone presumed some necessary moral analogy between the teleology of nature and the proper objects of the will, it would be fairly easy to connect these facts to moral prescriptions in ways that our society would find persuasive. We do not live in such a world, however. Indeed, we do not, sociologically, culturally, or intellectually, regardless of the ontological truth of the matter. To be sure, to make a natural law argument commendably implies the recognition that arguments based on authority are sure to be even less effective among those who don't recognize the authority of Catholic tradition or of the Christian scriptures. Hence the utter inefficacy of Bible-quoting street-corner Protestant preachers, however heated their rhetoric or lurid their apocalyptic admonitions. But in the early 21st century, natural law arguments in the United States, and more broadly, are ill-suited for trying to reach a secular audience steeped in a modern, liberal understanding of reason that in its theorizing about human beings is individualist and voluntarist to the core, built on assumptions about self-determination and autonomy, and whose view of nature is mechanistically materialist and post-Darwinian. I think that more or less aligns with the view of modern nature and philosophy as Professor Pfau articulated. Combine these things, and among other things, you get the basis for the instrumentalist manipulation of human bodies in the service of human desires assumed in Sergio Canavero's Surgical Ambitions. Appeals to natural law reflect, I think, the correct impulse. They seek something on the basis of which discourse and argument can proceed in common. But such appeals are off the mark in thinking that a classical, Thomistic understanding of natural law and right reason is shared with secular audiences, in contrast to at least some Catholic settings. Anyone who doubts this should try making natural law arguments about human nature or morality to an audience of, say, some philosophers, psychologists, sociologists, and/or literary scholars at Johns Hopkins or George Washington University. Be prepared for the glazed expressions, furrowed brows, and rolled eyes. If an audience thinks that morality is a culturally and historically malleable human construct, you are not likely to get far in talking about the virtues as the necessary and natural prerequisite for human flourishing as such. And if they think gender is as fluid as is implied by the 56 or 58 or 71 self-appointed designations to choose from on Facebook, depending on the current iteration and report, you can imagine how well claims about the natural complementarity of the male and female sexes is likely to go over. Something else is called for. As an alternative, I'd like to suggest a paradox, that if we want a Catholic view of the human person to be taken seriously, we should spend proportionally less time on Catholicism, the proportionally is crucial, and more on familiarizing ourselves with the mistaken ideas and ideologies, the bogus assumptions and arguments held by those we hope to reach. Then we can better assess how to proceed. Advanced, expert knowledge of Thomist or Augustinian anthropology is less important for this purpose than an awareness of the ways in which, for example, modern philosophical assumptions embedded in humanistic and social scientific disciplines, not to mention the practice of medicine, are intertwined with conceptions of human beings inimical to any Christian anthropological conception. These competing modern conceptions arose historically for certain reasons, so it behooves us also to be aware of that history and those reasons, which includes but is not exhausted by the history of ideas. Let me be clear that I don't mean we should or indeed can dispense with a sophisticated knowledge of Catholic anthropology and its relationship to a Catholic worldview when we engage with secular audiences. I'm saying rather that such knowledge is necessary but not sufficient. We must resist Catholic intellectual self-ghettoization if we want any chance of being persuasive to a secular audience and of doing more than talking among ourselves. And in order to overcome that danger, we have to show we belong in learned conversations by knowing enough about relevant academic disciplines and issues to be, quite literally, conversant with them. This is what gives us the basis for common knowledge and the recourse to reason and evidence that is ineffectively sought by appeals to natural law. being familiar with the assumptions, the methods, and the findings of academic disciplines besides Catholic theology and philosophy. Reason, much more broadly construed. As Catholic intellectuals, not everything we learn in this sort of study, of course, will be compatible with the faith. But we cannot know what is and isn't until and unless we learn enough to have a basis for judgment. Then we can start to see some things and to make some important distinctions. Is the problem in a given instance, for example, an ideological conviction masquerading as an empirical finding? Is it a modern Western innovation being claimed as a discovery about universal human nature? Or is it a hidden normative claim at work under the veil of putatively value-neutral description? These are different kinds of problems that call for different sorts of engagement. There are other kinds besides. The important and basic point is that if we want to have a chance to be persuasive to secular audiences, we have to show that we know what we're talking about. Otherwise, we will be simply ignored and dismissed out of hand, and justifiably so. Once we've shown we belong in a discussion, we can discern how it might be most fruitful to proceed depending on the issue before us. Speaking generally and formally, it is helpful, I think, to distinguish the defense of Catholic views of the human person from proactive criticism of secular views that are incompatible with them. In the next few minutes, I'm going to consider each of these in turn. So first, a bit about the defense, Catholic defense of the human person, and after that, a bit about proactive criticisms. Minimally, it seems to me, we should seek to be able competently to defend a Catholic view of the human person from intellectual criticisms. This, of course, means more than playing along with the common cultural discourse of subjective self-assertion. You have your belief and I have mine, characteristic of our wider individualist culture and the parallel postmodern perspectivalism of the academy. If Catholicism is true, we should strive to understand and to be able to show how its assertions are compatible with everything else that is known, regardless of the discipline and however it is known. This does not require an encyclopedic knowledge of everything knowable, with the acquisition of which is, of course, impossible. But it does mean familiarizing ourselves enough with the sorts of inquiry and character of knowledge in the natural and the social sciences, for example, to understand how they are relevant for Catholic anthropological views, related to Catholic concerns about the human person, and often employed in ways that conflict with Catholic doctrines about human beings. For example, it is common for secular believers, and I deliberately use that term, they have their beliefs indeed, it's common for secular believers to think that the findings of the natural sciences disprove the existence of God, the universe understood as divine creation, or the claim that human beings are embodied souls. Not so. But in order for us to know how and why, we have to know something about the history and philosophy of science in relationship to a metaphysics that can account for the possibility of a transcendent creator God being present to every bit of matter energy and moment of space-time, notwithstanding all the findings and indeed all the possible findings of modern natural sciences. So too, when faced with assertions that biological evolution reveals a disenchanted natural history of life on Earth without direction, meaning, or purpose, we have to be able to distinguish between evolutionary theories of genetic mutation in organisms in relationship to their environments and evaluative claims about the entire evolutionary process with respect to what is and isn't meaningful or purposive. I mean, the latter might inform us autobiographically about an unbeliever's subjective experience, but it has nothing to do with science per se. Catholic intellectuals in particular, and those trained to teach and defend the faith, looking at you, OPs, have a duty to see that its best intellectual foot is put forward, not because Christianity is most fundamentally, a matter of the intellect per se, but because shared life and fidelity to Christ is inseparable from truth claims, many of which conflict with other competing truth claims made by secular believers. We might think of this as one way of, to quote from 1 Peter, always being ready to make your defense to anyone who demands from you a reason for the hope that is in you. In academic contexts, this sort of capable articulation of the faith's compatibility with what else is known prevents Catholicism from seeming naive, unsophisticated, or irrationally fideistic in relationship to the findings of the natural and social sciences. Showing the faith's compatibility with all else that is known and knowable, a project consistent with Aquinas' theology and comprehensive conception of truth, will not in and of itself instill faith or change the hearts of determined skeptics. It is far from the fullness of evangelization. But if we do our work well, it should persuade those willing to see, a crucial qualification, that there are no intellectual obstacles to embracing what the church teaches. If people do not believe it, this is not because intellectually the faith is not believable or has somehow been subverted by historical evidence or scientific findings. And it should lead those who are not stubbornly determined in their prejudices to admit, whether they like it or not, that the church's claims merit serious consideration in intellectually informed circles. Indeed, it seems to me there is considerable room for pointing out that much of what passes for intellectual sophistication, vis-a-vis the so-called conflict between science and religion, actually masks a widespread theological ignorance in the academy as well as the wider society. Anything we can achieve along these lines is a positive step, insofar as the dominant, constantly reinforced narrative of modern Western intellectual history assumes that the advent of modern science and the Enlightenment in the 17th and 18th centuries intellectually superseded Catholicism and left it behind as an outmoded medieval relic through Weberian disenchantment. What is needed here, I think, is not straightforward recourse to Aquinas so much as simply pointing out the counter-evidence in the form of recent and contemporary sophisticated theological thinkers such as Henri de Lubac, Yves Congar, Bernard Lonergan, Hans-Urs von Balthasar, Robert Sokolovsky, Michael Buckley, Robert Spemann, or Joseph Ratzinger. They subvert the widespread but mistaken view that Catholicism is somehow incompatible with modern intellectual sophistication. If anti-religious critics haven't read such authors, they're not in a position to judge the putative intellectual weakness of Catholicism, any more than our convinced religious believers who are non-conversant with matters outside of, but relevant to, their doctrinal discourse. If Catholicism is true, then in principle, not only is it compatible with everything else that is true and genuinely known, but conversely, whatever is contrary to Catholic teachings has to be, as a matter of logic, mistaken, and thereby should be susceptible to critique of some kind. This suggests the second major way in which secular audiences might be engaged, namely through proactive criticism of ideas and assumptions, commitments and convictions contrary to Catholic anthropological views. For several reasons, this tack is usually more challenging and fraught than the defense of Catholic views. First, it is certain to be a non-starter to criticize secular views from Catholic claims based on authority, as Aquinas, of course, recognized. This means we have to find ways of arguing against secular positions that do not presuppose substantively Catholic claims. That is, we have to use intellectual tools that are shared with those we hope to persuade that there is something problematic about their own views. Not easy. This difficult aim leads to a second challenge, namely that it seems something like a psychological truism to note that no one likes to have their most fundamental assumptions about reality and human life called into question, whether the content of those assumptions is religious or secular. It gets people's backs up. It tends to make them feel threatened and uncomfortable. This points to a third related difficulty, namely that the proactive criticism of secular views antithetical to Catholicism risks alienating the very audience we would like to persuade. Unless we are careful, we risk doing more harm than good. And it is not always easy to know in advance what the effects of a particular argument might be. So we face some serious challenges if we want not only to play defense, as it were, but to go on the offensive while trying not to offend. That said, I think there are strong reasons for Catholic intellectuals to engage in this sort of discourse. Perhaps the most compelling is the conviction that deeply embedded, widely enacted, and often taken for granted anthropological views in the wider society, which have their articulate advocates in the academy, are, from a Catholic perspective, doing great damage, and as nearly as we can tell, will continue to do so. To give only the most obvious example, views about the alleged non-viability of fetuses as human persons have legitimated the legal abortion of more than 50 million human beings in this country alone since 1973. One could argue that we have a moral obligation to show as convincingly as possible how the views underlying this practice and others, such as Canavero's proposal to perform surgical head transplants, are dubious even in the face of those who defend and advocate for them. Second, and at the risk of voicing another psychological truism, most people are likely to entertain alternative views about basic questions of human life only if, for some reason, their own views have come to seem problematic. It is here that Catholic intellectuals can perform for them the paradoxically unwelcome service of drawing attention to previously unconsidered problems, despite the fact that this might occasion existential crises, precisely in proportion to our success. My remaining time does not permit me to develop any examples adequately, but let me mention just one that suggests the sort of thing I have in mind. One of the areas in which I think there's at least an opportunity to make some headway with a secular audience is on the basis for, the foundation for ethics, in part because of how poorly it fits with a scientistic, naturalist worldview that some of our colleagues purport to hold. What we can count on still, to a very large extent, although this might well be a historically and sociologically contingent situation, is the fact that there seem to be virtually no genuine moral relativists among us. I mean in the strong sense of those whose commitment to the sovereignty of individual autonomy extends literally to anything one chooses to do. In the words of John Rist, quote, large sections of a half-educated public, flattered as sophisticated, may be ready for the death of God. They are not yet ready for the death of public or of private morality. Thank goodness for that. One of its implications is that against assertions of moral relativism and the widespread view that there are no objective moral norms, we can invoke extreme counterexamples as a way of provoking fundamental questions about morality and its foundations. Very few alleged relativists, I think, are prepared to grasp the radically anti-realist nettle and concede, for example, that genocide or the enslavement of young girls for the sex industry or the torture of children for pleasure are morally acceptable choices of autonomous individuals exercising their freedom. These things are rather wrong. All but the pathological would agree. But why? On what basis can one mount a convincing critique of these actions or of any other outrageous offenses one might care to enumerate? The typical secular liberal recourse to human rights is an unstable halfway house that simply invites questions about what rights are, whether they are real, and if so, what they are based on. It is all well and good in the 18th century to speak of natural rights, as so many Enlightenment theorists were wont to do, including American founding fathers such as Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, having inherited Christian views about nature as God's creation, even if in some cases only in residually deist ways. But if nature is not creation, because there is no creator, then what basis is there for believing rights are real, rather than, say, leftover fictions from a discarded worldview superseded by scientific naturalism? Note that the purpose of arguing this way is not to cast doubt on the reality of human rights properly understood. It is to get those convinced rights are real to think about why they believe this, about the basis for their beliefs. In my experience, most academics like to think they're rational and that they base their views on evidence, so they are not disposed to admit that their deepest and dearest commitments are based on nothing but irrational assertions. Again, this is where you get their backs up. My own view is that insofar as no scientific investigation ever has or ever could turn up any empirically verifiable evidence for any human rights, they can be real only if their foundation is in some way transcendent, and only if it is accordingly acknowledged, recognized, that human beings are made in the image of God or some such functional equivalent. My time is running short, and so I don't have time to develop other potential lines of proactive critiques of secular views that do not presuppose substantive Catholic commitments, but which nevertheless might unsettle some complacent secular believers and therefore lead them to question the adequacy of their assumptions. The deeply entrenched and unbiblical idea that the acquisition of more and better material possessions is the high road to human happiness, for example, combined with the politically protected individual rights of consumers to buy as much as they want of whatever they want, is almost certainly linked to global climate change in ways that perhaps threaten the planet's long-term sustainability. Plenty of secular believers are concerned environmentalists, But are they prepared to examine the underlying ideologies of acquisitive consumerism and individual autonomy in a globalized economy that has led to the problem of climate change? Another avenue to pursue might be whether the fiercely polarized, poisonous character of our political culture and public life in the United States, evident now for some years, is really the unavoidable price we must pay and should be willing to pay for living in our democratic polity that protects our individual freedoms. Or is there perhaps something the matter with the notion of freedom most citizens take for granted, namely an expression of the voluntarist will and each individual's literally arbitrary desires? If we are to try to reach a secular audience that does not share many of our views and in all likelihood does not want to hear them, and if we want to try to counter erroneous and often damaging views about human beings, it seems to me our intellectual agenda ought to include endeavors such as these. We ought to train our analytical gaze on assumptions we can be confident are mistaken, because contrary to Catholic teachings, with an eye toward making criticisms on bases that we have reason to think might gain some traction with some of our secular colleagues. Let me give a few examples of such scholarship relevant for questions about human persons, which function in this way, even though it might well be that not all the scholars involved conceive of their work in this fashion. So in other words, they function this way, whether or not this was the intention of their authors. An example familiar to many of you, I'm sure, is that of the philosopher Alistair MacIntyre, whose oeuvre provides a devastating criticism of the weaknesses of modern and postmodern moral theories at the same time that it explains why moral arguments in our culture cannot succeed unless we change the views of those with whom we are arguing. Another similar example is the moral philosopher John Rist, whom I quoted a moment ago. His work, Real Ethics, for example, provides a similar criticism of the arbitrary incoherence of modern liberal ethical theories based on choice. A different sort of criticism of insufficiently theorized assumptions about human beings within the discipline of sociology, combined with a highly sophisticated, constructive conception of human personhood, comes from the outstanding book by my Notre Dame colleague Christian Smith, entitled What is a Person? Rethinking Humanity, Social Life, and the Moral Good from the Person Up. The vacuity of the ethical foundations of law in the absence of a transcendent source for justice are the focus of a terrific book by the legal scholar Stephen Smith, entitled Law's Quandary, some lines of which are taken in different directions and deepened in his more recent book, The Disenchantment of Secular Discourse. In a work that combines intellectual history, literary analysis, hermeneutics, and cultural criticism, Thomas Pfau has analyzed the consequences of the West's abandonment of a Platonic, Aristotelian, and Thomistic understanding of persons and human agency in his book, Minding the Modern. And I did something similar in my book, The Unintended Reformation, showing how the long-term consequences of the rejection of Catholicism in the Protestant Reformation and in post-Cartesian philosophy continue to influence the present with consequences that many of our secular colleagues also find disturbing. What all these works have in common, it seems to me, is a deep engagement with academic disciplines and a critique of ideas inimical to Catholicism in ways that do not depend on Catholic views. They use reason, in a sense much broader than natural law, from within and on the terms of the secular academy, in ways consistent with a Catholic view of the human person, but that do not depend on revelation, on authoritative tradition, or on the teaching of the magisterium. By way of conclusion, let me reiterate my awareness that this sort of engagement with the secular academy is far from the fullness of evangelization. It is at best a modest first step, if a necessary one, with respect to intellectual argument considered as such. We should not be unrealistic about our chance for success, at least not in any sudden or widespread way. A sober realism in this respect seems to me a corollary of a Catholic anthropological view, and to the extent that we're Augustinian, all the more. But insofar as that view also regards human beings as embodied souls and not as pure intellects, even though we are at the Dominican House of Studies, it seems fitting, if a bit mischievous, to give the last word to St. Francis of Assisi, or more precisely to the exhortation attributed to him, preach the gospel always, when necessary use words. This is salutary advice, I think, especially for those of us, and maybe I'm speaking to myself here more than anyone, who, through whatever combination of natural gifts, personal inclination, and habituation, tend to emphasize the intellectual aspects of the faith, despite it being, more fundamentally, a shared way of life among embodied souls, all of whom depend on one another and the common good to pursue their genuine respective individual good. Aside from erudition or brilliance, more convincing in conveying the truth of Catholicism and its view of the human person for most people, it seems to me, is the embodied witness of lived holiness. That is why St. Mother Teresa moved more Catholics and non-Catholics than did any late 20th century theologian or philosopher. And that is why, as nearly as I can tell, so many Catholics and non-Catholics have responded to Pope Francis in the way that they have thus far. So despite the ambitions of those such as Dr. Sergio Canavero, let's try to keep our heads as we seek productive ways to criticize his dubious anthropological assumptions and those animating many of our other contemporaries. Thank you.